You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Greg Boyd. You probably know who Greg is, but if you don't, well, just go listen to the episode about a month ago, the last time he was on Seminary Dropout. In fact, that's probably required listening before you hear what we're about to talk about today. So, Greg, thanks so much for being back.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So, you know, last time, wasn't that long ago, we talked about voting. You know, and here we are. We sit here today on the other side of the election. I wonder if now that we know what's what, do you have any misgivings about your personal decision to abstain from voting or any second thoughts about that?
Okay, well, this opens me to a charge of hypocrisy here, but I'll tell you something here. I wrestled with this a lot going into it. And see, the principle behind my own call not to vote was that I don't want to put any trust in that system. I want all my trust to be in the kingdom of God and in the power of the cross. But as this election presented a new thing to me, and it brought me to this conclusion, I ended up voting, but not because I have any trust in anything, but because I think Trump is dangerous. Yeah. And I felt like it's different to vote to say, you know, in this country, they ask you your opinion and you get to give it and it can make a little bit of a difference, maybe. And so they ask me my opinion and to say, I think he's dangerous to the Republic, is different than saying I have confidence in any political system. And so I found I could vote. I did vote. So I cast my anti-danger vote and lost.
That's so funny. I think that's the last thing I expected you to say.
So, to be honest, I never really considered that. This is the first time I confronted an issue where I did feel this, like, gosh, I should vote, but I couldn't get clear. Like, that violates my principles. But then I did get clear with it. Actually, it wasn't until the day before the election that I really came to, like, work this thing out in dialogue with others, you know. And I really don't believe I'm making up an ad hoc excuse. I think it's very different to say, yes, this is dangerous, and then it is to put your trust in the system.
It speaks a lot that you're being honest about that and that you – you know, we're able to come to that conclusion. Life is weird. it presents very strange circumstances.
It does, and that's why you always have to keep thinking. And, you know, the reality is that very rarely are there principles that don't have some exceptions or at least have nuances when you get to reality, because reality is infinitely complex. Principles and abstract truths are always abstract. That's what Bonhoeffer always taught, that there can't be a law, that laws are never sufficient to guide your behavior because the concreteness of the situation, only love, he says, can get you in touch with the concreteness of the situation. Every marriage, for example, is a little bit different, and interacting with it and trying to help it is be a little different. Love alone, living in love, will keep us in touch with the concrete. Whereas laws and principles, they're good general guidelines, the minute you press the off button on thinking about them or how they apply, you become a legalist. That we should never become.
What I've been thinking about most since the end of the election was, you know, for me, I am sick and tired of hedging my bets. I'm sick and tired, and I think this is kind of what you were saying. I'm sick and tired of saying, Jesus is Lord, Jesus is King, but in case he isn't, I'm going to put a few eggs in this basket over here, right? And I think we've all, like, had that struggle. I think that's what it means to be a Christian. And I think in elections past, the dynamic has been someone who will help vulnerable people and someone else who will help vulnerable people a little bit less, right? And I think as a Christian, I kind of say, well,
I don't know if it's my job to tell the government to take care of people. It's my job to actually do the taking care, right?
I'm with you. Absolutely.
But I think what I didn't think about was, what about when there's a candidate that we feel will proactively hurt people?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that there's, we're seeing with a fallout just from his rhetoric, which is the low-hanging fruit. There's also the concern about, in my opinion, about his temperament, where if someone insults him, he could press the nuke button, you know? I mean,
yep.
The guy is dangerous. To have a person with that temperament, I think it's dangerous. Which doesn't at all mean, I'm going to be clear about this, because you get the judgments start flying on both sides. And so I heard a guy on public radio a few days ago say, well, you know, you people who voted for Trump, this is all on you. You voted for a vote for Trump was a vote for racism. It was a vote for misogyny. And so you got what you voted for. Hope you're happy. Well, that's not fair. I know a few people who voted Trump. And from their perspective now, this is their perspective. It was the main driver for, I think, the Christian right was this is the one chance perhaps in a generation that they'll have to overturn Roe versus Wade, which in their view is going to save, you know, millions of babies. And so this one lady said to me, I think Trump's behavior and his mannerisms and his speech are deplorable. But what could possibly outweigh saving millions of babies? And so it was a lesser of two evils kind of a thing. And I there's all sorts of assumptions that she's making in that.
Right.
But the important point to note is that she is not a racist or a misogynist, and she regrets the negative fallout. But there would have been different kinds of negative fallout with Hillary, and one of them would have been, in her view, the killing of unborn children. And so we have to, you know, love believes all things and hopes all things, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13. And so it's important we try to give people with whom we disagree, give them the benefit of the doubt. They meant well. You know, you may don't have to agree with them, but they're not, you know, all racist and misogynist.
Yeah. I think I agree. I think that there are plenty of racist and misogynist people who voted for Trump.
That's becoming more and more clear. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for some people, they didn't see the ramifications like you're talking about, that it's this simple, you know, Trump plus White House equals millions of babies saved. And I just don't think it's ever been that simple before.
It's a difference of opinion. You know, I mean, just, you know, the whole issue of how do you wait, you know, when does full personhood begin? You know, there's that whole conundrum. And, you know, the church has never had a clear view of that. And how do you balance that with the women's right, you know, rights and all of that. And then, you know, just how much good would overturning Roe versus Wade do? And how probable is it that Trump will actually do that? How probable is it that Trump even gives a rip about abortion?
Right,
you know?
Right.
Okay, but I can see how a person could, you know, you'd mentioned earlier, hedge their bets. Yeah, there's some ifs and buts there, but still that is the consideration that outweighs all the other considerations. And then on top of that, there's the whole thing about, you know, a system that's in gridlock and a republic that's not working now. I mean, everyone grants that the House, Senate, it hasn't been working because of the ideological gridlock. And one could argue that we have to get that fixed or you know, this country's going to continue to go downhill. And they can make a case for that, you know. And it could be, I don't know, it could be that in a situation like this where you have ideological polarities, getting a person in there who's got no ideology, I don't think, that runs very deep in his heart, no convictions whatsoever, just wants to make a deal, it could be exactly what we need. Is a moralist, principleless person who is just out to become famous. Given the ungodliness of government, that could actually be what works. Now, then again, it could be an absolute disaster. I don't know, but I can at least see how one could think that way. And a good, intelligent person could come to that conclusion. Now, having said that, I don't know what percentage of voters actually had that mindset. And I think it is likely that the white voters, a good percentage of them, didn't give sufficient consideration to the blowback that could happen on non-whites. because they don't live in that world. And whites tend not to imagine what it like is like to not be white, because they don't have an experience in that. They don't live there, and they don't go out of their way to try to live there. And so their perspective is going to be very stunted because of that. And I'm sure that played into it, as well as, and this wasn't necessarily conscious for most people, but there's a white backlash. Studies have shown that when whites are at least not 80% majority, they start to feel like a minority.
Right.
And when they're not getting their way, they feel persecuted because they're so used to being the majority and used to getting their way. And I think there is a white reaction now to having a black president for 8 years, and absolutely, for a culture that's becoming increasingly post-Christendom, at least, post-Christian and pluralistic and multicultural and seeing more Muslims. I think it's freaking some people out. And this is kind of blowback for that. We want to go back to the, I want to make America great by going back to the good white 50s.
You know, on election night, I had my TV on. I had a browser open with one tab on one news station. The other browser was on Nate Silver's blog, watching that happen.
That poor guy. He had the meltdown of his life.
Oh, boy.
He got it wrong that night. Wow. You could see it on his face.
I was surprised at my own reaction to the results coming in. The reaction was fear, honestly. And I think it was two levels. And one was what you just talked about for fear for people of color in this country. We saw in the campaign, school kids, Latino and black school kids being bullied and being taunted and told to go home. Terrible, terrible things. And so now that side, you know, won the election. So how more emboldened are they? And I think we're seeing that in the days since it.
We're absolutely seeing it.
Reports are coming in.
It's been a dark week. It's been probably the darkest week we've had since, I want to say, the civil rights era. It was just incredible.
It's horrific. It's horrific.
Beyond the news, just the things that I have personally been told. It's really dark. It's brought up, and that is the thing, is this is one of the reasons why I thought it was dangerous. His specialty has been he's a bottom feeder. He knows how to play to the bottom, the worst elements of humans, and corral them to his advantage. And I was really hoping that was just a campaign deal. And maybe he will mature, and maybe he will, you know, mellow out. But I don't have a lot of hope for that now. That especially yesterday he puts Steve Cannon or Bannon into his chief advisor,
right?
Who is the founder of that whatever that alt right
Breitbart?
Breitbart. And just doing a little research on him, it's like the things he said and done are amazing in racist terms and misogynist terms. And at a time when all this is going on in the country, to see that that's his one of his top two positions is this guy with a track record that looks very racist. I don't know if it's going to get any better. We could have 4 years of this.
Yeah.
And God help us.
Yeah, I think the best case scenario is that he's a complete liar and won't go through with a lot of the things that he said he was going to go through on the campaign. And I think we kind of know he's a liar because of past things, but it's just scary to see how things will shake out. So that was my first fear, was for those people, people of color. And then on the second level, I was afraid because I don't think that people realize that great empires have fallen in the past.
They all have fallen.
And
finally, the one that hasn't.
That's right. That's right. I hope I'm not putting my eggs in the basket of the Republic of the United States. But at the same time, I really like being able to provide food for my family and having electricity and not being under the threat of a nuclear weapon. People who voted for Trump would tell me not to worry, that God's in control. But of course, these things have happened in the past. There's nothing special about us that this couldn't happen to.
Yeah. Oh, it inevitably will. I mean, and there's some who argue we've already passed our crest. We've had a good run for 240 years. But all empires eventually self-implode, and ours will do the same. But you'd and whoever is in that generation, assuming the Lord doesn't return, is gonna it's gonna be terrible. It always is terrible at the end, and so you hope that we're not yet. Of course, it could be. And I don't. I think God's in control of the big picture. But I don't think he controls who gets to be president. If anything, the devil has more influence than that. According to the New Testament, Satan says, all the kings of the world are mine. I give it to whoever I want. So work that out in your democratic process. But I do think that this is where having it's really important when it comes to fighting fear. Because it's good to be concerned. It's not good to be gripped by fear. Fear can be, it's not a good motivator for action. It can be stifling. It can choke you. And that's where I have my eyes on Jesus. And he wins in the end. And, you know, this is a long story, not a short story. Live in an eternal narrative, not a finite narrative. And so that gives me confidence. Far from making me check out in the present, it gives me motivation to be in the present. Because I know that I'm on the winning side of things, and I'll keep on. And even if I die, that's not the end of the world. We're all going to die. And so, but having an eternal perspective, I know that that's not the worst thing either. So yeah, the one advantage to having a situation like this, is I think it makes it easier for people to hear the message that there's an alternative kingdom. There's an alternative kingdom that you can trust that will reign forever and point people in that direction. Because the more hopeless the world gets, the more receptive people are to the hope of the kingdom.
Hey friends, it's me, your host, Shane Blackshear. All this month, I've been talking about The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery by Ian Morgan Cron and Suzanne Stabile. Do you want help figuring out who you are and why you repeatedly stumble into the same self-defeating patterns? Consider the ancient personality type system called the Enneagram. That's what The Road Back to You is all about. In this book, you can find out what your number is, what your wing is, and what that means about you, what that means about who God's created you to be and how you work best. So go check out this book. You can get 30% off by going to ivpress.com/dropout. Find a link to it in the show notes if you want. 30% off, The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery. So I think my question now is, how do we live in a Trump presidency? I mean, it seems like there's an awesome responsibility. I don't know if the election changed any of that. But to take care of vulnerable people, to take care of orphans, widows, the stranger in our land.
Yeah. Well, this is one aspect. You know, the thing is, the darker it gets, the more advantage it is to the light to shine. You know, it's like we get to contrast more. And that's a good thing because it's how we should always be. And this is an opportunity for the church, if it's willing to step up and separate itself from trying to play wise advisor to Caesar and stop trying to ride the coattails of government and start just doing what the church is called to do. This is an opportunity for the church to demonstrate the beauty of the alternative kingdom. For too long, the church has surrendered to Caesar what we should be doing. And then we fight over what Caesar should do about it. You know, how should Caesar take care of the widow, the orphan, you know, the immigrant, all that? That's the church's job. And so maybe the more the government fails in those areas, the church will actually realize, hey, it's our job to pick this up. And so we're to be welcoming the stranger and providing for the hungry and the poor and the homeless manifesting a new humanity created in Christ Jesus that reverses Babel and that tears down all the walls of division that have separated us. And if the church can do that, it'll provide a beautiful contrast to what's going on now. But I see the church should always be doing that. It should never have stopped doing that. And if the church did that at all to any significant degree, eventually I think you'd have government coming to the church saying, hey, how do you guys do that? Because you have something that works and we can't seem to figure it out because they can't figure it out. You know, here's something I read this last week, and it really illustrates, I think, beautifully what the church could be if we would, and how much is lost when we surrender stuff to government. Okay, I didn't know this until I read this last week, and now I can't remember the source. I wrote it down somewhere. I'll find it. But in the 1850s and 60s, you had a number of very socially active Christian movements going on. This is sort of the Charles Finney era. They were all amillennialists. They thought they were going to bring about the millennium.
Sure.
And so they're very engaged in not in trying to get government to do the right thing, but in just doing the right thing. And so this is where you had, you know, Charles Finney started Oberlin College, which was the first co-educational college, and they fought for women's rights to be educated. It was the beginning of the temperance movement when they were, you know, so many people were just in bondage to alcohol. So they were like, you know, getting people free from these addictions. And there's a number of action groups like that. Well, one of them was that the church saw the abortion rate in the mid-19th century was as high as it was per capita before Roe versus Wade. Well, they didn't try to pass a law against the abortion, but they just said, what can the church do about the abortion issue? And so they developed these programs to come alongside women when they were getting pregnant who didn't want their children. And they said, will you let us walk with you to go full term on this? And so you have to say you ought to don't abort your baby. It rather, what can we sacrifice right. to make it feasible for you to go full term?
Yeah.
And they came alongside of prostitutes and everybody who was in the situation. And then they would say, if you want to keep your child, we'll help kind of teach you how to do that and walk with you on that. And if you want to give your child up for adoption, well, we'll help you with that too. And they developed adoption agencies and they got Christians families that would sign up to take in these kids. And between 1860 and 1910, the abortion rate in America was cut in half.
Oh my gosh!
Now compare that with what's happened since 1973, when it's become, and there's a long history here we could get into, but we don't have time. But where abortion and homosexuality, you know, you had these red button issues that were dangled in front of the evangelicals which was combined with, and this isn't a coincidence, with a very conservative economic program that gave a lot of tax breaks to big businesses. And this was all thought out. This was designed by the folks who wanted to get this voting block. They saw an opportunity here. And so they used their influence to create this kind of platform that combined these hot button issues with conservative economics, Reaganomics, trickle down. So you have big breaks for corporations and stuff. And at first it didn't work because, you know, in the early 70s, evangelical Christians just weren't into the abortion issue. That wasn't the head of the Southern Baptist Convention. I think it was 76 or 75 said, we're not going to weigh in on that issue. That's not going to be part of our platform. There's room for disagreement on that thing. Well, 4 years later, it is their platform. Okay, ask, what have they gained? For all that fighting, 45 whatever years it is, all that fighting, the politicians have always promised to be in their corner, but they've never gotten anything from that. And in fact, they've only lost ground on all that. Now, maybe with Trump, they'll reverse Roe versus Wade. But even he just says, we'll return it to the states. He's not going to make it a federal law. Anyways, they haven't gotten anything. And abortion rates have gone down, but no thanks to anything that the church has done. It's more been the availability of birth control, and it's in the other whole room for discussion. When the church is just the church, we actually can make a difference in the culture. But when we surrender stuff to Caesar, all we do is become a little footnote. And if anything good gets done, the credit goes to Caesar rather than Jesus. And we're not showing the contrast of the kingdom of God. So that's why I'm always telling folks, you know, we need to fast from all this political fighting and just be the church that we're called to be.
So the episode of this podcast immediately after the election, I kind of gave, you know, opened the show with kind of saying my piece and talked about, if you really think God's in control, well, that means that we step up and we're in solidarity with people who are, you know, being persecuted or are fearful right now. And even mentioned being, you know, participating in nonviolent civil disobedience, if that comes to that. And I got mostly a very, very wide positive response to that. I had somebody who emailed me and was not, they weren't rude or demeaning or anything like that, but, you know, said, what about all these years with, you know, when abortion has been legal, why have we not practiced civil disobedience there? And you know, I gave a response and I won't go into that greatly, but we tend to act like for 8 years when George W. Bush was president, that abortion just stopped for 8 years. And then it just skyrocketed again once President Obama got into office.
Right, right.
It seems like both parties, to your point earlier, have really learned to harness the abortion issue for their own means.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's not been much change in that. Republicans could easily partner with Democrats to pass bills that would, you know, diminish circumstances that make abortion seem like a good option for people, but have chosen not to do that. And again, like you said, it seems like just to be the carrot that's been dangled out in front of people long.
Yeah, it's a classic case of it really symbolic of where our government is right now, where you have this gridlock. I mean, in polls, and I haven't seen this in the last 5 years, but the ones that I have looked at before and studies done on this, the majority of Americans agree. It was up close to 90% agree that the fewer the abortions, the better, and the later the abortion, the worse. Now, we don't agree on all the metaphysics of when this unborn child becomes a full person, or the fetus becomes a human person, or gets a soul, or all that. Some say the moment of conception. Others say no. And the church has actually always had a diversity of opinions about that. Some people are surprised to hear that, but in fact, Thomas Aquinas didn't think that the baby got a soul until it was born and took its first breath, because God breathed into. Mm. Now, that's that. But so here's the thing: we all agree on this. But rather than working together to create that reality, to lower the number of abortions and to prevent later term abortions, the two sides are locked in this ideological position where everyone's afraid to give an inch, because if they give an inch, the other side wants to take a mile.
Yeah,
and so you got people who are defending, you know, partial birth abortions, even though they've got to believe that that's repugnant. But they're afraid that if they give up on that, then this the other side is going to want to say, okay, now we have to outlaw birth control, because, you know, or at least certain kinds of birth control, IUDs, because once the egg's fertilized, it's a full human. And that just shows this, that politics in a pluralistic society is the art of compromise. And I used to try, I've given up, but I used to try to help people see this, that sometimes to make the way to ensure that you won't get any of what you want is to insist on getting everything you want. And I was trying to help people see that voting for a candidate is, if you're doing it in an intelligent way, it's not just asking the question, does this person agree with my personal convictions? You want to ask the question, will this person actually accomplish the things I want to get accomplished? It could be the case that if you keep voting along ideological lines, you're actually contributing to more abortions, because this person is not going to bend an inch to try to actually lessen abortions. They're so in love with their ideals that they won't compromise to create the reality of what you really want. And I remember telling this person, this guy was so mad because I wouldn't endorse this pro-life candidate. I was trying to show him the complexity of this. And I said to him, okay, what if this person's known for their rigidity and you actually are voting for them because they won't compromise? But can you see how that might be actually killing kids? Your vote could be contributing to the death of unborn children, which is the very thing you don't want. And if you voted for a person who had a less rigid stance and actually was willing to work with the other side, it would help create this reality. That was my first. This is like in 2004, I think it was, where I actually got into this quagmire with folks. It really was a kind of eye-opening experience to how naive some people are when it comes to voting. They think it's like saying, "What color? What flavor ice cream do you want?"
Yeah, it's black and white. Yeah.
And how they're not aware of the complexity and the ambiguity of politics. I really begin to see how it deepened my conviction about the importance of distinguishing between your faith on the one hand and your vote on the other. Because see, faith operates in absolute categories, and they don't translate into politics. I totally get a person can have a personal conviction and yet vote in a very different way, because you're voting for what's best for this country and what you think will work in this country. You just can't translate the passion of faith into an ideology. And when you do, what you get is what you get with ISIS or the Christian equivalent of that. And it's never good, certainly not in a pluralistic social democracy. It just doesn't work at all.
You made me think of something else, and that we haven't heard much about it because I think the Donald Trump news has overshadowed it. But the other winner Tuesday was the death penalty. Three or four states had death penalty measures, and they all came out pro-death penalty. Some were repealing where state senates had outlawed it, so they could not outlaw it anymore, and some were just flat out voting for it. It is also very difficult for me to have sympathy who vote for someone because of their abortion stance, but won't vote against the death penalty or even, you know, anti-war candidates. It's very hard for me to, I don't doubt their sincerity, but it's very hard for me to see them as being intellectually honest about that issue. When every
I agree. Pro-life, you think would be pro-life. It's not pro-fetus. It's bigger than that. And you ask, you know, what candidate do you think will be the best for life overall? The irony is that it tends to be the case with the religious right that they're vehemently pro-life, uncompromisingly so, which, if I'm right, may contribute to the killing of unborn children. Yeah. But they tend to be the most who are for capital punishment and the most pro-military, most against gun control. It's like, I don't have a clue how that works. How did that combination come about? I think it's because you have this pro-nationalism trumps pro-life. And so the pro-life, as long as it's, you know, it doesn't conflict with pro-nationalism, but when you start asking questions that are more under the category of pro-nationalism, that's when we need this great defense of this great country and to conquer all the evil in the world and whatever. It's a strange thing. It's just like the same combination where you have, you know, the groups that are most against government intrusion, right? That government governs best, which governs least. They want minimal government, right? And government shouldn't be telling you what to do. But they're also that group that says, but they should define what happens to a woman who's got an unwanted pregnancy. They have the right to get in the womb.
Yeah.
But they should invade our privacy. Yeah, there's all sorts of weird bedfellows in this.
One party believes life begins on this side of the birth canal. Another party believes it ends in this side of the birth canal.
Yeah, at least, and for the concern for it. Yeah.
I'm kind of convicted, and have been for a long time, to not really worry about labels and just kind of that Christians should put their heads down and do the hard work that you were just describing. I think it's always been hard for us who aren't in the mainline church and also aren't in the religious right. Do you have any thoughts about what we do with the term evangelical at this point? And do you care?
I don't care either way. I still will identify as evangelical if I'm in an audience where I know what that term means.
Mm-hmm.
But see, we don't just get to define words. The words have meaning, and they change over time. And so when you use a word, you have to ask the question, not what do you mean by it, but how will the person hear it?
Yeah.
And for a good percentage of people now, the word evangelical is not a good word at all. My neighbor, you say the word evangelical, bam, he's got his amygdala going. He's thinking Pat Robertson. He's thinking, pro-Israel, anti-Palestine at all costs. He's got a whole, It's infused with baggage. And if I want to reach my neighbor, I would never use the word evangelical. In fact, I would side with him against evangelicals
right.
in terms of what he means by it, because everything he means by it is stuff that I'm against.
Yeah.
So I don't usually self-identify as evangelical any longer, unless I know that the people I'm talking to mean it theologically. I have a high view of scripture, you know, and they hold to these traditional creeds and I believe in evangelism, you know, and I believe in having a personal relationship with Jesus. And so the theological distinctives, most of them, I tend to agree with evangelicals. But when it comes to the cultural ramifications, I'm in a different, I orbit a different universe.
I mentioned the idea of civil disobedience and what place do you think that might have in the life of an American Christian going forward?
Well, there's a lot of room for disagreement on this thing. I'll just be honest. I don't get the protest that's going on now. So I don't get it why that would be a Christian thing to be. All right, there's people saying we reject president-elect. And they're carrying signs like that. We're against Trump. We don't accept it. Well, how does that work? here's the thing. When Trump said that this election's rigged, you know, we're crying out, well, he's undermining democracy because the system only runs if you trust it. If you begin to suspect that things can actually be rigged, well, then people stop voting and we'll have ourselves this, you know, chaos, war. Mm-hmm. We'll settle elections the way they did in the good old days when you just bomb each other and, you know, whoever's left standing wins. It only works if you trust the system. Well, now, and I think that was right to point out that when a leader talks about it being rigged, that's dangerous stuff because you're undermining the very fabric of this democratic republic.
Yeah.
Well, you do the same thing if you're a loser and you say, I don't accept your results. It's what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I just don't get that. I couldn't see that as a kingdom thing. I think civil disobedience comes into play when I am, at the very least, when I'm being asked to do something that is contrary to my kingdom convictions. So, for example, if I have a person, and I've had this, illegal immigrant living in my house, and I'm asked to turn them over, I won't.
Right.
And I'll pay for that. But that's, I think, where when your principles of kingdom living conflict with the requirements of government, you have to go with the kingdom. Acts 5, Acts 5, who should we obey? The laws of God or the law of men? And so we have to side with God. Otherwise, I say take it on a case-by-case basis. I will tell you that, in my view, because we aren't – the way God operates over government is different than the way God operates in the kingdom of God. And you see this clearly in Romans 12 and Romans 13. In Romans 12, we have Paul here giving instructions on how Christians are to respond to enemies. We're to turn the other cheek. We're to feed those who are hungry, our enemies, and give something to drink if they're thirsty. Never repay evil with evil, but always repay evil with good. And never exact vengeance, he says. Never retaliate. We're not allowed to be ever involved in violence. Then, in the next chapter, and remember, in the original, there was no chapter division. So Paul's, this is the same train of thought. Then he says, here's how God, or at least one of the ways God exacts vengeance. We are to leave all vengeance to God. One of the ways God does it is through the sword of government. And he says they're all governments have been established, or the word there is tasso. It can mean filed. It's not like all governments reflect God's will, but God files governments. The term has the connotation of filing things, like a librarian filing books. The librarian doesn't have to agree with the books or even like the books, but given that it's this kind of book, the librarian will put it in the right place. Well, governments are violent. They've since the fall, they've always been violent. They're predicated on not trusting God. They trust in the sword. Jacques Ellul argues, and I think he's right, that violence and nationalism are two sides of the same coin. You couldn't be a nation without being willing to engage in violence to keep law and order inside your land and to prevent threats outside your land. And so they're going to use a sword. And since they're going to use a sword, God will be at work to use that to minimize as much evil as possible. Because there are plenty of folks who will only not do the wrong thing if there's a threat against them. Now, for God's people, that shouldn't be the motivation at all. But if in the world, the threat of pain is meant to be a deterrent. Hmm. And so I don't feel it's my place as a kingdom person to tell government not to use the sword. They're going to use the sword. And the New Testament assumes they're going to use the sword. And so I wouldn't be saying that government should. Now, having said that, the less violence there is, the better. And I think it does something to our perspective of for all people, not just Christians. I think for all people, we lessen the value of life when we kill anybody. And so I would always advocate for against war as much as possible. At least prolong it. That's the best you can hope for, I think, is eternal procrastination. And I think the death penalty is damaging to human beings. It's not just to the person being executed, but what it does to our mindset. We still keep in place that the myth of redemptive violence, or that redneck retaliation thing. Whether I would protest it or not is a different question. But
yeah. When I asked about civil disobedience, it's funny, I wasn't thinking about the protest. And I mean, generally, obviously some illegal activity can and does sometimes happen during a protest. But, you know, in general, people have the right to protest. So it's not even disobedience in that.
Yeah, that's
frame.
True.
But I agree. To me, and I don't blame people who are protesting, I understand that disenfranchised people need an outlet. But I kind of agree. The idea of a protest, the way I understand it, is you're demanding something, and it's kind of like, right. Well, it's done. Like, it's over now. So
no, maybe one person tweeted that I asked this question on Twitter yesterday, and one person tweeted back saying that he thinks that they're not trying to reverse the election. They're simply voicing their opposition to what he stands for.
Sure.
And okay, I get that.
Yeah, I agree.
But then they shouldn't say, we reject president-elect. Kind of came the wrong message.
Talking about undocumented immigrants, that your example you gave is exactly what I had in mind when I'm talking about civil disobedience. So
Yeah. And see, here's where I would minimize the importance of questions about what to do at events. It's okay to discuss that, and I do discuss that. Should Christians be involved in Black Lives Matters movements and stuff like that? And we could discuss that. But all of those things are token, in a sense. We don't live in them. We go to them, and then we carry on with our life. And you could be, this happened with that 1% movement a couple of years ago. Where they were protesting how wealthy the wealthy are, and it's not fair. And well, you could go out there and protest that. And say, we should be doing more to take care of the poor, and then go back and live in your $10 million home with your Mercedes, and nothing's changed. You could do that and still be a person who gives less than 1% of their income away. But yet you feel good because you participate in the protest. So I'm much more interested in how we vote with every decision we make throughout our lives. That's where your life really makes a difference. And if the church does that as a collective whole, it can make a tremendous difference. That is the important question. And that's a much more costly question. It's not about, let's have a debate about what government should do for the poor, what candidate would be best. Fine, go ahead and debate that. But how? What am I doing? How have I adjusted my living, my lifestyle, to make room for time and resources to actually make a difference with the poor? That's the question. And if we do that as a church, if a church asks that, what can we do? Collectively sacrifice to serve those who are needy and to manifest the love of God, which is the call. We're ambassadors, billboards for the kingdom of God. Man, a church can make so much difference. And Yeah, Woodland Hills, not to toot our own horn, but we're like feeding. So I think the last information I got was somewhere around 3,500 people a month in our area. And those are folks who would otherwise it would be just we as a church could fight over which candidate is best going to do that. But instead, we just do it. And then on top of just serving people, that's what grows people spiritually. You know, when they regularly are said, okay, you guys, here's the grocery list. Will you go out next time you go grocery shopping, fill up these bags with these items to restock our food shelf? Well, that matures people spiritually, and then now they get to see how they're making a difference. Yeah, you're gonna have to spend $60 to fill up one of these bags. But you've been budgeting for that. You've been, you know, sacrificing. You didn't get in that extra cable television show just so you could do that. And they get to feel good about that, and it matures them, and the body matures, and the glory goes to God. That's the way it should get done.
Real quick, my favorite Occupy Wall Street story. When that was...
That's the... I was trying to think of the term for that.
Yeah, right. The 99%, the 1%. So when those protests were kind of at their peak and we had a local one here in Austin, that was a much... It doesn't seem that long ago, but my life has changed a lot since then, so much so that during that time, I was delivering pizza part-time, trying to make ends meet, right? So somebody...
So you're saying you're not part of the 1%, I take it?
Yeah, shocker, right? Yeah. Podcasting pays so well. So I was delivering pizza. Somebody from somewhere else in the country had called into the company I work for, ordered a pizza, and said, just deliver it to the protesters, Occupy Wall Street, right? Mm-hmm. So I deliver it, I bring it there, and they admittedly, they were disorganized, you know, but I found this kind of table who was taking things like that. From Occupy Wall Street, I didn't get tipped. I was delivering pizza. Like, Occupy Wall Street stiffed me. I thought that was so emblematic of kind of the problems with that movement at the time.
Well, it illustrates what I'm talking about, you know. They should be generous. They should be generous while we're not generous.
Exactly. You know? Like, exactly.
It's all, you know, we always have to be aware how easy it is to point the finger and to maximize the faults of others and minimize our own faults when Jesus tells us to do the opposite. And so it's always best to for kingdom people to ask the question, you know, first look in the mirror and what can I do? Right, before I want to go out there and tell them what they should do and give my superior ideas about what government should do, look at yourself and it's make it personal. What can I do? Hmm. Do I tip justly?
Last thing I want to ask you on a completely different subject. My midweek group in my church was meeting yesterday and we were talking about what we were going to do, like all the midweek groups in our church, what were they going to do next? And one of the things that it looks like we're going to do is read Letters to a Skeptic together.
Oh, good.
Which was one of your, that was one of your earlier books, right? It's been a while.
Yeah, it was 1992, I think it came out.
I was saying, you know, I think Greg kind of feels that he would answer some of those questions differently today. And somebody said, well, I wonder what he would say. And I got to be that guy that said, well, I'm talking to him tomorrow. I guess I can ask him.
Yeah. Here I am.
Here you are.
I've evolved since 1992. in 92, I was just beginning to get uncomfortable with the evangelical establishment in America. I was just beginning to wake up to how bought in we were to the politics and the culture of America. But it was just the beginning of the journey. And my theology wasn't nearly as robustly kingdom as it became throughout the 90s. And so, for example, the way I talked about the atonement in that book, I would now phrase it quite differently. My view of atonement is definitely... I wasn't a penal substitution guy back then, but I also wasn't clearly anti that. and I didn't have a clear Christus Victor model. And I used the traditional evangelical jargon. My view of salvation was quite different. I still had a kind of a mindset that the moment of salvation starts with that decision, you know, and now you're saved. 2 minutes ago, you weren't. Now you are. And so that's that magical moment, you know, that all important decision. whereas I think I have a much more holistic understanding of it now. And I suppose I haven't read it for 20 or so. I'm not sure, but I'm sure there's other areas that I would have phrased things differently. But the core arguments I still believe in the core arguments. Like when I talk about my reasons for believing in God's existence or believing in the historical Jesus, those are different. I also would have, throughout that book, I was always sort of, my dad was always wanting to talk about, what about this Old Testament God?
Yeah. Yep.
And I was always put that on hiatus. It was like, well, no, let's just talk about Jesus, you know, because he's the, and a lot of it's because I didn't have a good answer for that. Whereas now, I think I do. And here's a good time to plug my forthcoming book. Last 10 years, I've been working on this, a sort of cross-centered interpretation of the violent portraits of God in the Old Testament. It's called The Crucifixion of the Warrior God, and it will be coming out on April 1st, 2017, Fortress Press. Yay! And then a more popular version will come out August 1st.
You're not putting one over on us? That's April Fool's Day.
I know.
We've been waiting for a long time for this one.
Some people have asked me that. This is just going to be an April Fool's joke. But no, that's when it's scheduled. Now, things, of course, I go to an open future, so it could change. But we're working feverishly at getting it out by then. So they'll be coming.
Well, I read Letters to a Skeptic in the last year, knowing a little bit about what Crucifixion of the Warrior God was about. And that was the most glaring thing where I thought, I bet he would answer this a little bit differently.
Yeah, at that time, I was still trying to defend God's behavior in the Old Testament. And so I gave even reasons for why God might have committed genocide. And I talked about how bad the Canaanites were. I've since learned that most of the archaeologists agree they weren't any worse than anyone else at the time. But that's all I had to go on. You know, we're all works in process here, and so
you do that.
In 2000 and I guess 10 it was, it would have been 2008, I think. I began to work on what now is called the Crucifixion of the Warrior God, and it was going to be I was going to put together all the best arguments I had for why God maybe behaved so nasty in the Old Testament. Because I'd accumulated those over the years. I thought someday I got to write a book on that. And then the clearer I got about Jesus and about the centrality of nonviolence, the more problematic those portraits became. Mm. So I was getting questions on this. So I thought I need to write I thought it'd be a summer project, a short little book giving all the best answers you can give. Well, when I started to write that book, about 50 pages into it, I thought, I stepped back and I said, this book sucks. This doesn't do it, you know. My answers weren't at all adequate. And they're the best that were out there. It basically would have been Paul Copen's book, Is God a Moral Monster? That's the sort of book I had planned on writing. And he gives as good arguments as you can give, I think. But I don't think they are at all adequate. Because the challenge is not just to make God look a little less monstrous. Or even make God look ethical or justified, you've got to make God look Christ-like.
Yeah.
In fact, more than that, Jesus says, all scripture is about me. Moses wrote about me. It's all about me. And then, you know, in Luke 24, he opened up the disciples' eyes so they could see how all the law and the prophets pointed to him, and especially, he says, pointed to the fact that the Son of Man had to suffer. So all scripture ultimately is to be read as pointing us to the cross. So the challenge is not just, why do we have this genocidal portrait of God in the Old Testament? Go slaughter every man, woman, child, and even the animals as an act of worship to me. That the concept of harem, which is the word that's used when it says slaughter them all, it has a connotation of devoting something to God. You are consecrating them to God by offering them up to Yahweh. In other words, you were doing to entire tribes of people what people did with child sacrifices. They offered the child up to God by killing it. Well, that's what you're to do to this entire population. So the question is, how does that portrait of God actually point to the God who's revealed on the cross, the self-sacrificial, nonviolent, enemy-loving God who's revealed on Calvary? That's the question that needs to be answered. That's the challenge I took up with Crucifixion of the Warrior God. So I had to scrap my first book and start over again. And that set me on an entire different trajectory. I had to virtually get a PhD in ancient Near Eastern studies, you know, but it was exciting. I've loved every minute of it. And I'm looking forward to when the book comes out.
Well, me too. I have a feeling it's going to be worth the wait. So you've got kind of a more scholarly book. That's Crucifixion of the Warrior God, right? And then you're going to have
a two-volume work. It'll be approximately 1,400 or 1,500 pages.
Whew. And then you got one for the regular folks like me that's going to come out later,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they'll be entitled Cross Vision, Making Sense of Violence in the Old Testament. Yeah, and that'll be out August 1st. And that's around 200 pages or so, I think.
I'll probably read both, I'll be honest.
Well, I really, the reason we wanted to not do it simultaneously is because the average layperson isn't going to read Crucifixion of the Warrior God, but the scholars should, because that's where you get the full case. You know, I just dig into all this ancient Eastern evidence to confirm this cross reading, and I develop it carefully, and I interact with the church tradition, and you know, I consider all the counter arguments and things like that. In the popular version, I have to cut a lot of that out, most of it out actually, and just give the bare essential argument. So, scholars, I would encourage to read the robust academic version, but for lay people, I think the popular version should suffice.
Love it. Okay. Tuesday night midweek group at Austin Mustard Seed. There you go. There's your
There you go. There you go.
Your rundown from Letters to a Skeptic, which, by the way, if people who are listening haven't read that, it's fantastic and it's lovely. If you don't know the premise, it's letters between Greg and his father about Christianity. Yep. His question, answering his questions.
My atheistic father.
Yeah.
It was it's been, you know, that has been just such a blessing. It's of all the things I've ever written, that's the one that by far and away is the most wide read. It's been translated in 18 languages. I get emails on a fairly regular basis. I have for the last 25 years of people who tell me the stories of how that book was used. I've had three or four who have read it to a spouse on their deathbed, or to their father on the deathbed, and discussed it, and they came to faith before dying. And it's just some beautiful stories like that. It's just been, and I get letters from folks, you know, from China, translated in Chinese and all over the place. And it's just been beautiful to see how God's used that. I get tons of testimonies. My dad's up in heaven doing the jig. I think he's very happy how God used his skepticism to help others.
Oh, wow. The part, I mean, I love everything about that book, but I love the little touches of that you left in there. You know, he's asking about his grandkids and what they're up to and just the little personal stuff. You changed it very little from the actual letters that you wrote back and forth from him. I love that.
Well, believe it or not, I had to edit out all my father's little, he was the world's most creative cursor. I think everyone, when he was angry, he could do entire paragraphs without a single clean word. He was a genius at swearing. It was, as kids, we were sometimes just marvel on the spot. He'd make up these, you know, terrible, terrible, vile, grotesque, paragraphs and just string it together. It was just amazing. And so, I had to take out some of, I left in some of his colorful language, but not much. I had to take out that. And then there's some tangents he went on. And so I did have to edit it, but I wanted to leave as much of the personal element in as possible.
Yeah, we may not have been ready for that in 1992.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing was is that he was 74 when he finally gave his life to Christ. And you don't expect much change from a 74-year-old, but he changed incredibly.
Hmm.
He was up to that point all of his life. He was kind of a cantankerous guy. You know, the world was just stupid. You know, he was really an activist on race issues. So I grew up with a prejudice towards Southern people because he was always cursing Southern people.
Oh,
you know?
Interesting.
And the Bible Belt, he hated the Bible Belt and all of that. But otherwise, aside from that, he had the morality of a amoeba. He just, he gave me condoms for my 15th birthday. He thought that was just natural, you know,
Thanks, Dad. And
left us pouring out and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, he's just always mad at the world. And if there's anything wrong with him, you heard about it. He was like, you know, backache or whatever. And he would just be cursing. after he gave his life to Christ, he mellowed out in the most incredible way and became a person so full of gratitude. It was just, in fact, the last conversation I had with him, and I always get choked up when I talk about this, but he was, right after he gave his life to Christ, he had a stroke, and then he had another one, and then he got Bell's palsy, and then another stroke. He ended up having 10 strokes and Bell's palsy. Plus, he got cataracts in his eyes that they couldn't fix, so he went almost completely blind, and he was almost completely deaf. So he got incontinent. He had to wear diapers. And this is a guy who used to be so proud. By the time he was 84, he was just in a wheelchair and couldn't see and couldn't hardly hear. Well, we had a meeting, a family reunion of sorts, at this, how he had moved up here to Wisconsin so that they could be around some relatives on his wife's side who were in the medical profession. They could take care of him and stuff. And, you know, he never knew what was going on around him. He couldn't hear. And so he would sometimes in the middle of it, we'd be talking about something, and he'd blurt out, "What about those Vikings?" You know. But at one point, we were around this table talking, and he just starts crying. And so I go over and kind of shout in his ear, you know, "Dad, what are you crying about?" And his response was, "The Lord's been so damn good to me. I'm just so thankful the Lord's been so damn good to me." And here he is, blind and almost deaf and in a wheelchair. And he's full of his gratitude to the point of crying. And that is not the same Ed Boyd that I grew up with. And then we left there. That was the last conversation I had with him. And a month later, he had this massive stroke that ended up killing him. But I'm just so thankful.
What a story of redemption. I mean, I think most of our older relatives, when they get 70 or 80 or so, we say that's whoever they are is just the way they're going to be till the day they die. What a beautiful story.
Yeah. It's a, and you know, it, and this comes out, I think, somewhat in the book, but you wouldn't have, I didn't see any opening in him when I started this conversation. It was a kind of a Hail Mary pass, to be honest. I tried to engage with him a few times, you know, person to person, and it never went anywhere. He'd get mad and I get mad, and it just, we agreed to not talk about it. And I was just grieving because I was preparing for this debate with this Muslim, and I was putting together all my reasons for believing Jesus is Lord and stuff. And I was thinking, this is really compelling stuff. And I've never had a chance to share it with him. And I know he's a very smart, intellectual man, and reasons would matter to him. And I've never been able to give him the reasons. And so that's when I just thought I'd shoot off a letter. Maybe that would work. Let's just have a correspondence here. And fortunately, it worked. And it turns out there was an openness there. You can't judge a book by its cover. Maybe part of his hardness towards, I mean, for one thing, he identified Christians with the Bible Belt and couldn't stand that.
Sure.
And that was part of the reason. Just giving him an alternative to his prejudiced view of evangelicals was helpful. But having a context where you could talk about it calmly and rationally, I think that made all the difference in the world, too. Mm.
Greg, you've been such a good friend to this show and making yourself available. And I've not been shy about what your words, your sermons, your tweets have meant to me.
Oh, thanks.
So thank you so much.
Well, I'm honored to be here. It's always fun talking with you. This is good stuff. Good stuff.
Cool.
Yes. Great questions.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
Come back after April 1st. All right.
I'll be there. Just ask and we'll air it.
Thanks, Greg.
God bless. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,